We begin with Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't. If this law is true, we simply must ask, where can one find best value for one's food dollar?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,391st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Dijon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofon.com. Wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. So, if the third law of the food chain is authentic, who am I to argue with me? We simply must ask, where can one find the best value for one's food dollar? Well, who better to ask than warfighter, now businessman, Patrick Montgomery, who is the CEO and founder of KC Cattle Company and Valor Provisions Cooperative. Patrick, welcome to the food chain.
Michael, thank you for having me on.
First of all, thank you for your service. For whom did you fight, and what did you learn about in that fighting that led you to become a businessman?
I was in the 1st Ranger Battalion down in Savannah, Georgia, a member of the 75th Ranger Regiment. We were hot and heavy in Afghanistan when I was in. Feels like yesterday, but that was coming up on 12 years ago. Funny how I don't feel like I'm 12 years older, but somehow that magically happened. Yes, how it made me a business owner. I'm not one of those guys that had a master plan. I always wanted to be a war fighter. I didn't really think much past that future. I thought that's what I'd do for my working career, and it didn't end up being that way. And since exiting, it's been a journey. I'm not one of these incredibly intelligent entrepreneurs that started with a huge business plan and a lot of VC or angel investor dollars. I just didn't want to sit behind a desk, and it's led me to this new fight. Which is exactly what you're talking about, you know, bringing knowledge and power to the consumer about food. And it turns out it's a bigger fight than the one I was in before.
Well, you have a much bigger enemy, I think, gets right down to it. And it's an enemy with a lot of money and a lot of power. Well, again, thank you for your service. We are all appreciative of those who serve. So KC Cattle Company and Valor Provisions Co-op. So you started a cattle company in KC, which of course is Kansas City, which of course is the barbecue capital of the universe. So isn't starting a cattle company in your Kansas City a bit like Coles to Newcastle?
It would be if it wasn't Wagyu. When we started that, we were one of maybe four online that were shipping throughout the entirety of the country. It was still kind of a novel product. Definitely has caught fire since then. And it's kind of cool. We're part of the original squad that, you know, was really kind of slinging Wagyu beef online, and it's become a lot more since then. And it's been a fight. You know, 10% of United States farms have shut down since 22, and that number will continue to go up unless something changes drastically. So,
why didn't you go with the Kansas City market, a local market?
Well, we started out literally slinging strip steak, ribeyes, whatever it was, out of the back of a pickup truck here in Kansas City. And yeah, we were serving maybe 10 or 15 restaurants local. But you know, restaurants in itself, it's a really tough business to run profitably. And I, you know, maybe a year into the business, identified that the market in Kansas City wasn't matching it perfectly. And I saw there to be an opportunity online. And so that's what we did. We, you know, it's funny when I talk to other perishable shippers, and they had fancy like testing facilities where they tested packages and how it would perform. We had a heater in our bathroom here in our office, and yeah, I think it's up to about 90 degrees, and we'd throw a package in there with dry ice and gel packs packed this way and then that way and see which one performed better. And yeah, that's where the special operations side kicks in, because you just figure out how to get the job done with the assets you have at hand.
You have a wonderful story about getting discovered with your hot dogs.
We do. When we launched the e-com side, PR was the only marketing dollars we were spending, and we had a cool story. There's not a lot of first generation farmers out there, and you know, people were interested in that side of it. They were interested in the war fighting that I did previous and how I came to the idea of Casey Cattle Company. But what it ended up being our tipping point was creating an all Wagyu beef hot dog. The Food and Wine then deemed the world's best hot dog in a viral article where we went from shipping 20 orders a week to having 12,000 roll in a 12-hour time period. It was pretty stressful. It was definitely pretty stressful, but you put a plan together, you get to work, put your head down. You know, 8 weeks later, I looked up and, you know, we'd hired a bunch of people and we'd shipped 12,000 orders and, you know, we could gain the customer base that loved our mission.
How did you do in the COVID years?
Well, 20 and 21 were really good to us. I mean, mostly because two of the big four shut down and what we had been preaching since the inception of the company that, you know, there's four companies that control 85% of the protein throughout the entirety of the United States. Two of those shut down and all of a sudden folks in New York and California couldn't find protein. And they went online to find it and they found us. And so we grew exponentially throughout that time period. And it wasn't until 22 that things really kind of started to reverse when Russia invaded Ukraine. You know, everything that goes into a beef cow from start to finish at best went up by double. And at worst, sometimes, you know, in cases of fertilizer and your beans, your corn, all the things that are used to grow a beef cow went up by anywhere from 4 to 12X.
What about the price of beef then? Everything's gone through the roof.
Yeah, people mention that. You know, the biggest reason, this is tough to dig into the data, but because the USDA skews it pretty hard, but when you kind of dig through the white noise there, you know, the big reason for that is there's not a lot of beef cattle inventory left in the United States. Your generational ranches are shutting down because the economics don't make sense anymore. And in conjunction with that, the consumer has figured out that beef may not be a product that is killing you, right? A single ingredient product that's killing you. And so beef consumption is on the rise by 20% year over year. And those two combined have resulted in the highest beef prices we've ever seen in this country.
So you made another leap. Tell us about Valor Provisions.
Well, if I'm being honest with you, Michael, it came out of desperation. I considered it a rock bottom. I was driving down to a Ranger buddy's place in Texas, and we'd been through the ringer. And if I'm being honest, I had no idea how we're gonna make it through the next month on paying our bills. And on that drive back, I just found myself angry, would be the best way to put it. I don't think there's 1.2 more than that, 1.4 million Americans that have died for this country, for it to be run by oligopolies at best and duopolies and at worst.
And we're talking about the big four.
Yeah, talking about the big four, but you know, it's not, as you well know, it's not unique to the beef industry. Our entire food industry is controlled by these companies that could care less if they're poisoning you or not. And and whether or not the cowboy is not something you can find out west, and it is only something you can find in a history book in 10 years, and that is the direction we're heading.
Few of them still exist.
I know.
I
want them to continue to exist, and that was the original. How we are not the only ones that are in this fight. I've watched a lot of the friends that I've made in this industry shutter their doors since COVID, and you know, if something didn't change, you know, that's continuing to be the case, and we're going to become one of those statistics. And if I'm good at anything, Michael, it's, you know, I'm not always a smart rager, but I'm definitely a strong rager, and I like a good fight. So that's,
apparently
that's
you're a surviving ranger too. You're still
maybe,
here with us.
Maybe like a little bit like a cockroach is a spirit animal. I don't know.
Well, Valor Provisions is a co-op.
It is.
So what you're apparently trying to do is to scale up a little by working with other like farmers, like ranchers. Are you a farmer or a rancher?
Well, we don't do any row crops, so we'd be considered a ranch here.
Okay.
I was crazy enough to get into the ranching side. I don't know if I'm crazy enough to get to the row crop side too.
Hey, Jay.
But yeah, the question that formed Valor Provision was how do we not only provide the product to the end consumer at a price point that competes with the grocery store, because the American consumer wants to support the American farm. People are broke right now and inflation is rampant. And it's not going to get better anytime soon. So how do we provide that price point that competes to your grocery store, but also make sure that we're taking care of the farmer ranch and that they have a future to pass on to the future generations?
Well, how do you have a price point that can sell and provide a margin? Out here in California, we have a very big cooperative, privately owned cooperative called Driscoll's Berries. And what they do is they combine a lot of different berry farmers together and have them do things the way they want them to do things in order to sell their berries under the Driscoll name. And it's worked very well for them. So in your co-op, do you have a specific kind of guidelines as to how to grow the beef?
Where I'd say it differs a little bit, Michael, is... people are they're across a really wide spectrum on what they want for their beef, right? Whether it's a true grass finished animal or Wagyu beef that they know is not just, 50%. They know they're not going to just get a choice steak that they could have bought for $18 at Walmart. They want bison. They want commercial beef. They want pasture-raised chicken. They want the pork. Rabbit, all these different proteins. And so it's more so that the USDA has a loophole that exists for just about every single product claim that put on a product in your grocery store. And so for us, it's like, I don't care if you're following the USDA standard. If you say it's a grass finished cow and I come visit your farm, then that animal better only consume grass or hay.
Well, want to see the calf cow on the grass, right?
Yes. Yeah, so that's more sort of the vetting process for us. Is we believe firmly that the way the animal's treated when it's standing on its own four or two legs determines the quality of the end product that ends up on a consumer's plate. And so we want to get eyes on that. We want to see what your operation looks like. We don't onboard a vendor without going to do a on-farm tour and see the animals and see the processing. And the cool part for us is normally in the protein world, you mentioned all the other competitors that are out there. They either know beef really well, they either know econ really well, or maybe they know more about cattle than any of those two. And we're one of the few that really knows the entire spectrum. I know just enough in all categories to be dangerous.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we do come back, I'd like to get into the whole business. And there's a lot in grass fed, we have to parse and figure out what's what, so we know that we're really getting what we pay for. And what we're really looking for is good value for our dollar. And what I have found over the years is that cheap food does not necessarily equate to value for the dollar. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jane Radio Program. I'm Michael Olson. Goodness sakes, this is the 1,391st edition. And we have with us Patrick Montgomery, who's the CEO and founder of KC Cattle Company and Valor Provisions Cooperative. What caught my attention about Patrick was his insistence that grass-fed is the value. So do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we are on the hunt for real value in our food, not talking about the cheap prices you get from discount supermarket food. I'm talking about food that holds real value for the dollar. And I have a sneaking suspicion that it's not in the cheap food you get at a discount from a supermarket. Beef?
No, it's in the works. That's what's coming.
Okay.
So that's what we were talking about before, but it's in the works.
Well, I'd like to start by a quick story. I once had the opportunity to spend some time at Polyface Farm in the Virginia countryside. Joel Salatin runs the pasture-fed animal operation there. He invited me to go out and watch as he cycled his grazing cows from one pasture to the next. And as he took the fence down and the lead steer came running happily from the old pasture, which had been all chewed down, to the new pasture filled with beautiful green grass, I looked at this cow and swear to God, it had a big bleep-eating grin on its face. Now I wonder, do you think there is such a thing as a happy cow, Patrick Montgomery?
Yeah, and when you taste a bad steak at the supermarket, you can just about guarantee that wasn't a happy cow.
Well, it certainly was a happy cow. So grass-fed, there's a lot of grass-fed propaganda going around. It seems like when you go to the supermarket now, everything says grass-fed. And I'm thinking, I'm not so sure about that. I have visions of chickens running around in steel mesh floor being grass-fed or something that's just not real. I just don't believe it. I don't believe it's all true. And to find somebody that's really doing grass-fed food, why, that's real food, I think. That's why we're looking at you today, Patrick Montgomery. Do you really grow cows on grass?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out some of the things you just said there, starting with, like, can you really trust the grass-fed you buy at your grocery store? I'm not going to say no across the board, but I would argue that unless you're buying from that farmer ranch, probably you shouldn't. It's an $87 billion total addressable market, and anything with that kind of dollar amount normally attracts some bad players. So, you know, the USDA standards for a grass-fed, grass-finished beef is, I mean, I'm going to break it down simple here. Basically, they're not fed corn, and their confinement has to be a little bit better than what you'd see at a JBS feed yard. Yes. So, no.
Kind of like what happened to the word organic. Farmers had this great idea, and then they gave, how are we going to protect our word organic? And so I know, let's give it to the federal government. And so they gave it to the federal government, and now you can grow organic food and water. So
yep.
That's what happens. It's just the way it works. Which leads me to an important question. Why just four? Why there's the big four control, what, 85% of the beef protein? Probably of all of animal protein, I don't know. It's just four of them.
It's all edible protein, yeah.
Four? Why just four?
Well, it's actually not the first time we found ourselves in this position in American history either. There was an act passed in 1921 called the Meatpackers Trust Act, right? And back then there was five players. If you've ever read the book, The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, that book was what led to Congress passing that act. And essentially, you had five companies, the last of which, this is almost ironic or poetic, I'm not sure which, but the last one to exist, that was one of the first acquisitions the JBS made when they entered the United States market in 2001-ish timeframe. There's a whole story that goes in from the 1980s on. There's actually a really great book to glean some insights on that called Barons. It's all about the different oligopolies that control our food market.
Yeah, we had him on Food Chain Radio Show.
It was. And why four? And this is left and right. The guardrails have been taken off the SEC and the DOJ for acquisitions, right? I believe in a free market, but when you have a consolidation like what we've seen in the last 40 years, we no longer have a free market for the consumer. Your farmer or rancher can't go to your local grain co-op and fetch the best price for whatever crop they grew because they're all owned by the same company.
Kind of like trying to compete with China. They own all the factories and they have all the money.
China owns our largest pork producer. They own our second largest seed producer, Syngenta. They own one of our bigger, well, at least all the manufacturing for one of our largest ag chemical companies is all of that is produced in China. Yep. And then you had JBS and the second largest for the beef production side that they're both headquartered out of Brazil. And so you got to ask yourself, like, and do these other countries really care about what happens to the American farm? And on top of that, you know, a lot of this was done in the name of environmental impact that American ranchers and farmers were having in the United States. Well, you know, arguably, or we are now having a much larger environmental impact because we've exported that to countries that are less regulated. Sometimes common practice in this country often covers up common sense.
So in essence, we ended up with four big corporations controlling 85% of beef, and they did it using...
That's all protein. That's pork, chicken, everything. All of it.
And they did it with the same, I guess, financial mechanisms that they did everything else. So the whole world is controlled by fewer and fewer corporations that get bigger and bigger and bigger. I've often remarked and wrote a book about this. I see agriculture growing in two directions, very, very big and very, very small. And I think you're one of them who are pursuing the smaller direction because you're doing very limited production of very high quality products. Now, when you buy the commodities in the commodity world, like Smithfield Food and the biggies, those who grow the least for the most win. But when you're growing specialty crops and selling it directly to people, that rule does not necessarily apply, especially when people are educated. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's really important. I agree with you because, you know, people love to throw darts at why farmers and ranchers do certain things that they think may be unhealthy. But you also have to keep in mind that, you know, we're the only species that's held the exponential growth rate that we have essentially since the Industrial Revolution. There's 7-8 billion people on planet Earth. And in order to feed those, if we were doing that, the same farming practices we were doing 100 years ago today, you'd see a large portion of the world starve. So there is a counter argument to this. And, you know, where I've always said is, yeah, there's a happy medium. Just like most of the arguments we make in America, it's probably not the far right extreme or the far left extreme. It's probably somewhere in the middle, left or right, that makes a whole lot of sense to feed the world's population. And, we have to be smart about the way we do things. And we, you know, if we want to have a planet Earth that is happy inhabiting our population, we have to take care of her. And I would argue that American farms and ranches do the best job at that. But, you know, we do need a free market to be able to thrive. And, you know, it's pretty rare to see anything other than corn and soybeans raised in row crop throughout the Midwest. And, you know, you ask yourself why. There's a whole lot of reasons for that, and I'm not sure if it should be that way. So,
well, that leads us to how do those big four make their meat cheap? Corn and soybeans, right?
Corn and soybeans that are heavily subsidized by the United States that we then export to other countries that have better economics for raising beef cattle. Australia, Mexico, Brazil, and even Canada, New Zealand are some of the big ones there. And, you know, they have cheaper land prices. They have cheaper labor prices. They're less regulated when it comes to, hey, I want to put a feed yard here. I don't have to go get, you know, 15 permits and talk to 12 different government agencies that just start chopping down trees. And cool. You know, it doesn't matter if it's in the Amazon rainforest or not. So that's kind of the sad part that Americans don't think about when they're like,
you know, that'll probably be our recent history, is that we've exported all of our dirty industries to China and elsewhere, and then think well of ourselves because we got rid of pollution. But we haven't gotten rid of the pollution. It's still there. It's just elsewhere. And that increases our costs of production and reduces their costs. So there we're stuck in that rotation. And is it possible to get out? Well, you're trying to find a way. And the way to do that is to sell directly to people who are looking for real food and real value in their food. How do you feed cattle grass?
Yeah, and so I'm going to make a segue here. We raise Wagyu on this property, right? So
okay.
Wagyu, people care about marbling, and we hammer the grain. We feed them a lot like the traditional Japanese Wagyu would have been fed, which is a high caloric diet. We want to see marbling at the end. So if you're talking grass finished, that's where we go and look for the person that is their specialty, and that is what they're doing. And we go tour that person's facility and make sure it's not just the USDA regulations for grass-fed, grass-finished beef, that they are going above and beyond that to do that. And when you ask, how do you do that? Well, one, a couple of things people don't think through. Grass doesn't grow in most states during the winter, right? So you have to feed some type
Montana,
of hay.
For and, example.
What's that?
Montana. For example,
Montana or here in Missouri, we definitely did from, you know, September. Well, you know, depends on the winter, but somewhere between September and November, there's not enough grass that grows because it's dormant to feed the cows. So you have to bring in hay. And not all grass is created equal. Here in Missouri, you know, a lot of what we grow is fescue. And so I'll tell you right now, a cow that is raised from start to finish on fescue, this is what your beautiful Midwest lawns are, created with. And it tastes a little better than an antelope. Let's put it that way at the finish, because you are what you eat. And so, you know, you have to go to a climate that has for this, you're thinking Montana, you're thinking Washington State, even down in the Southeast, like the Carolinas and places like that, can do really well with some of your coastal type grasses that do have a better caloric intake. You want to hammer stuff like clover. You want to hammer stuff like brome, the better type of forages for the cow. And you want your hay to be the same, because hay, when that is dried out, you lose a lot of the caloric value of that hay, so you have to feed more of that dry matter. And then on top of that, you can also do what's called silage, which is essentially fermented hay.
The Plains Indians, a name for the grass that up around Custer's Last Stand, they called it the greasy grass. And I always thought, boy, I'll bet the buffalo from the greasy grass must have tasted really good.
You better believe it.
Then what? So you have two different products. You have Wagyu, and you have grass fed. Correct? Am I on the right track there?
Well, so it's our Wagyu are raised on grass, right? But we also hammer the corn. Yeah, we believe in a variety, just like
because
most folks do.
Because that's what people are looking for.
They get a lot of distiller greens and things like that. People, when they buy a Wagyu $80 steak, they want to see that thing look like a Wagyu steak, and you can't do that with grass. And so if you're buying a steak that's well marbled, you might want to ask yourself some questions there.
Okay. It's all
paying for that marbling. Yep. The intramuscular fat, You want to see a Kobe-looking steak.
Okay, and then the grass, it looks like a regular steak.
Yeah, it'll look like a regular steak. One important thing to note is if an animal is eating a lot of grass, there's something called the world will correct me if I get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's beta carotene, right? That's a nutritional component of grass that we're not capable of converting to energy, but cows are with their compartmentalized stomachs.
Their greatest gift.
And that beta carotene will actually change the color of that fat. So if you're eating a true grass finished steak and you're seeing a nice white fat cap to it, you should probably also be asking some questions. There should be a yellow tinge to the actual fat.
Okay.
Same thing as carrots.
Yeah. And when we come back, we're going to take a quick break here. But
you can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Food Chain radio program. Today we're talking about finding the real value in food. And we're talking specifically in protein food. And we're talking with Protein from Patrick Montgomery, who is the CEO and founder of Casey Cattle Company and Valor Provisions Cooperative. List a lot of value in grass-fed. That's probably why you see grass-fed everything on the grocer's shelves these days. Probably you can even find grass-fed popsicles. Who knows? It's that popular. How did it get so popular so quickly, Patrick?
Well, I think you're seeing a huge influx in, people are people are getting their information from non-traditional media sources, a lot of influencers. And across the board in the health world right now, on the carnivore diet side, on the keto diet side, anything that's heavy on the red meat, you're seeing people preach that they should be buying grass-fed. And I think that's where you're seeing the proliferation of grass-fed in your grocery store.
Poultry as well, and pork as well. It seems like everybody wants to find that grass-fed quality. And so I thought, well, what's the big deal with looking for benefits of grass-fed? And there's an incredible list of benefits. I thought we'd go through them with Patrick, and maybe he can say true or false. Grass-fed beef tastes better.
I would definitely argue that one's false.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Both my ranch. So when you're talking about...
Are you talking about fat and grass-fed? Is that what you're doing?
Or even a prime steak, right? Like our Navy SEAL partners up in Montana that raise all of our Angus for us. You know, they grade out 80% prime. They hammer the grain on the last 6 months. And that is where that caloric value comes from for the cow. And they convert that to intramuscular fat. That's what makes it grade out choice prime. You're not going to see as much of that on a true grass-finished cow. The tenderness can still be there, which is equally as important as the amount of fat. And I would argue that the diet, the type of forage for the grass-fed, is going to make a huge impact on the palatability of that steak. And as we discussed before, they're hammering KY31 fescue here in Missouri from start to finish. That is going to be a non-edible steak.
Won't be able to eat it. And because it's eating the wrong kind of grass, I guess it's just like anything else. Grass is not all the same, so it depends. I often say, who was it that said, we are what we eat. Well, we are what we eat as well. What we're eating is grass-fed fescue, or in the case of venison, they're chewing on sagebrush. You're going to taste it. And it's going to be carrying that value. So beware. That said, somebody made a comment that there is the same difference between wild salmon and farm salmon. To me, there is a difference there. But again, that depends on when the salmon are caught and so on and so on and so on. So when you're fishing for wild salmon, you don't get the controls that you do when you eat farm salmon. Depends on who's farming the salmon. When you're feeding your cattle on grass, do you practice rotational grazing?
We do, yeah, and it's big. And it's a little more labor cost, right, which is why a lot of farmers are allergic to it, farmers and ranchers, but it does decrease your inputs quite a bit. And so I always try to preach that when I am talking to a farmer or rancher.
So in rotational grazing, you're moving the cattle, much like the buffalo moved before the Europeans showed up and shot them all. They would go from one section of prairie to the next and leave behind all the residues of their having been there, which created a great soil fertility. And thus the greasy grass, the Montana there. Okay.
There's zero chance that was bad for environment back then.
They were lacking in environmentalist. So, okay, grass-fed beef contains more nutrients.
Yeah, the big one there is that, again, it comes down to the fat composition. The composition of that fat is going to be drastically different for a feed yard cow versus a true grass-finished cow. But you got to be careful there because a lot of those studies are having read through the demographics and the controls for those studies when you look through them. Because if they don't match the USDA standards, I heard this from a big, big influencer the other day, one of the main guys for a carnivore diet, and he was telling consumers that when they go to the grocery store, they'd be better off to buy grass-fed than organic. And that is so, so false, because there are still, you know, you can put as many chemicals as you want to grow that grass, right? It's not organic. Versus organic, you at least know that you're having a lower intake of some of the handful herbicides and pesticides that go on the ranches a lot of time.
That is the one good thing left in the word organic, is that it means that you can't use harmful pesticides.
And I would argue that's more important than the fat composition of the cow.
Okay, good. Fat being the most difficult nutrient to get in nature. And we've spent decades trying to avoid saturated fat. Comment?
I think I don't want to comment on in a pro or, and you shouldn't listen to me. I sell beef. I tell people this, they got to start thinking, right? And so if I'm sitting here, I'm like, yeah, eat as much saturated fat as possible. Well, I sell beef for a living. So should you trust me if I say that? Probably not. Here's what I'm going to say is I grew up in the, I still remember in first grade walking through the food pyramid, right? And having it shoved down my throat that I should have 10 to 12 servings of grain per day. And it, especially now as I sit here in the seat, you know, running a company that is big on informational events for consumers on what they do with their food. I just think that's so incredibly asinine that our government shut that down our throats, and we have ended up incredibly sick as a population because of it. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what comes out in the next 20 years, how the consumers are like, I just want to eat single source, single and a single ingredient food. And I feel like that's what you should focus on. And when I started to see the proliferation of the carnivore diet, I was like, well, I'm not going to be for or against this, but I do want to try it. And I monitor my saturated and unsaturated fats very regularly. So I'm like, I want to see what this looks like and what this does to my own health. I think it just helped cleaning up my diet more than anything, but I do eat a tremendous amount of red meat. And I think part of the reason we are so sick is that people don't eat enough fat, good fat, in their diet.
And good fat contains all kinds of wonderful things, antioxidants, nutrients, and so on and so on and so on. High in omega-3, low in omega-6, right? That's the good
stuff.
Good for the brain, good for the heart, good for everything.
Good for your hormone levels. It's the building block for all your hormones within your body, which, you know, those things are incredibly important to maintain your healthiness as an entire being.
Linoleic acid.
Another type of fat.
It's called.
Yeah, it's another one that, and this is actually cool on the Wagyu side. What makes Wagyu is two types of mutations, one of which is it increases the amount of intramuscular fat, and second, it actually changes the fat composition of the animal, how they deposit that. And so I want there to be a fat study in the United States. I don't want to pay for it, and I don't want to be a part of it because I want people to trust it, but I have been a big proponent of trying to get one of these influencers to do a fat study based off of, hey, I want to see what it looks like with these three different test sets.
Well, I want to know what it tastes like.
The Wagyu?
I want to know what a good Wagyu steak tastes like.
And we're going to have to send you some, and maybe send your son some as well. I think he's earned it.
Iron. Let's see. An excellent source. So many women of childbearing age are short of iron, and also children. B vitamins, high in B12, B6, K2, folate, niacin, much higher than in regular beef. So if you're eating grass-fed, you're likely getting the best, most concentrated source of vitamins, minerals, electrolytes, and magnesium, and potassium. All of these things are great for the heart and brain.
It is. And arguably, you know, We always have to meet the consumer where they are. That's always been tough for me to learn. And even if you are buying beef from a grocery store, you know, buy the best that you possibly can, but a little bit of that in your diet on a weekly basis, there are some things in there that are really tough to find bioavailable anywhere else in your grocery store. And so I would definitely argue that it is not a bad thing to eat beef a few times a week. Selenium, choline, all these different things, they're really, if you take a multivitamin for it, you're absorbing much less versus right. If you eat a pound of ground beef or a steak. And you mentioned kids. I did it for all four of my children. I was fortunate enough that I owned a beef company, but when they were all babies transitioning from mom to real people food, you know, we asked the nutrition or our pediatrician what to feed them. And he's like, I tell the parents this all the time. Nobody does it because it's a lot of work. But you know, buy the food, baby food from the store, and then puree it with some brown ground beef, and it should be about 50-50. And the benefit for kids there is tremendous because we are robbing them of nutrients that they desperately, especially the fat, because they need that for the brain development and their skeletal system. Yes. And it is, that is sugar and carbs.
Yep.
And they need that for energy, but they equally need that protein and that fat and the iron and the choline and the selenium and the B vitamins. It has a tremendous effect on children.
So there you have it. You know, when they actually look at some of the nutrient content of grass-fed beef, it appears as though the percentage of the good stuff is much higher than can be found in regular feedlot beef. Well, at the beginning of this feature, we learned about Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Now I pick up the second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. You folks at Valor Provisions, KC Cattle, are focusing on selling food to people way far away, like me. You're trying to build a customer base with people from all over who are very specific about their desire for good, value-laden food. I always suggest that you gotta find food with its farmer's face on it to be certain to get that kind of quality. I'm looking at you. I can see your face, and I know you. But how do you maintain that presence so that we know you are what you say you are? Because everybody has this way of saying they are something, and we can't believe all of them. How do we keep focused on Patrick Montgomery and others like you who are doing God's work by producing really value-laden food?
I would argue if you can find that farmer, you should do that before you order from us. We're shipping to you from Kansas City. You know, that product might originated in Montana, it might originated in North Carolina, it might originated in Texas from a farm that we visited. But that's not the mission of Valor Provisions, is just to have you be a customer and for us to exponentially grow. The mission is to save the farm. And so if you have that farmer close to you, do that. Where's a good place? People are always like, man, I live in the city. Like, come on, be realistic here. You know, putting your smartphone, meat locker near me, right? And there's going to be one within an hour of that. And it's going to be a small mom and pop meat locker. And that place is going to survive by working with their local farm. And you know, that's a place you could probably buy from. You want it. They're not all created equal. There's a chance they buy from the big four. But you can at least start there or call them and say, hey, do you have a farmer that you work with that does this, that's close? And that's a good place to start. What Valor Provisions is exactly what you're saying. Convenience and health don't go together, right? When you're at a gas station, you're picking the least of the most poisonous things there to feed your body, because you have to eat. And a guy like me, I'm on the road all the time. I'm talking all the time. I live a busy life. So I have to have guardrails that make sense. If you're a busy person and you just want beef to show up at your doorstep that competes with your grocery store pricing.
One thing we do know, when we shop at Valor Provisions for our protein, We're going to get protein from those who served our country. And thank you for your service, Patrick Montgomery. We look forward to getting a taste of that Wagyu beef of yours. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live. Boom, boom, boom.